is it truly the end of the world as we know it, or just another chapter in an ongoing saga? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be back with you, Barry. Tired of doing reruns, so it's good we're back in the studio. Everybody's really busy. This is the time of year. I know you should explain to folks that as a professional lobbyist, this is your busy time of the year, especially on the two-year cycle.
Yes. The legislature meets for a two-year cycle beginning in the, as we're in, the odd year and ends up in the even year. But in the odd year, the first 6 months of the year are totally consumed with a little thing called the state operating budget. That's where they spend all of your tax dollars, ladies and gentlemen.
You know, all your tax dollars plus.
Plus many of your federal tax dollars that they draw back down.
Some of your children's tax dollars as well.
That is true as well. And sometimes they ask you to spend your tax dollars by taxing you more on certain items. But anyhow, so yes, this is a busy time of the year, but it's really no excuse for us not getting here in the studio and getting some things done, because life goes on whether you can be involved in it directly or not. And one of the things that is going on right now in our culture, in America, is the issue of whether or not the nine people in black robes, or actually only five, because that's the only number that they really need, are going to issue a ruling sometime in the month of June that would, as Dr. James Dobson of Focus on the Family fame would say, be the end of Western civilization. Now, you know, it is kind of funny when you put it that way, but I understand Dr. Dobson's deep and abiding concerns over the issue of whether or not five people in black robes who got there by appointment are going to basically force upon 319 million people the idea that God didn't mean what he said when he said that a man and a woman should leave and cleave and come together and form one flesh, and that's marriage. They're hearing a case that came out of the Sixth Circuit, and Ohio is part of that Sixth Circuit. There are actually four states in the circuit: Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, and Tennessee. Or excuse me, Kentucky and Tennessee. Indiana's not in it. Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And there were cases out of all four of those states on round one of two issues in the ongoing debate over whether those who have same-sex disorder, and I'm calling it that,
yeah,
should be lauded, applauded, and recognized in the same way that we recognize heterosexual marriage. Chuck, I've always thought they're only asking half the question with this. They want same-sex marriage recognized. Maybe they should ask for same-sex divorce to be recognized along with it in the case, if they really want the whole package.
Well, if you recall, that's already, there was a backdoor attempt in Ohio to get a judge here to hear a same-sex divorce case.
Yes, there was.
That was a couple of years ago, and we mentioned it on the radio show. I'm not going to go through the archives. If you feel like doing that, you can do that. But the fact is, there was a judge, and I think it was either in Franklin or Fairfield County, if I remember right, that was asked to hear a case. And the backdoor reason for hearing the case was to get somebody to say, well, if the state recognized gay marriage enough to hear a divorce case, then that's a tacit admission that they recognize a homosexual marriage case, which is directly forbidden by the Ohio Constitution.
That's right. As a matter of fact, Article 15, Section 11 of the Ohio Constitution is the Ohio Marriage Amendment. I had the pleasure of personally working on that issue and getting it on the ballot and helping to generate the support to get it passed into our Constitution in 2004. Now, here we are 11 years later, Charles, and we're looking at five people in black robes. And I say five because really that's all you need. Of nine justices, you only need a majority of five to be the ones who basically say arbitrarily, Well, no, we don't see that there are any rights for the states to define this issue, and the federal the Constitution, specifically the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, applies here. Well, you know what, Chuck? I'm okay with part of that argument. I'm okay with the part of the argument that says that the 14th Amendment might apply to the states on issues that the United States Constitution hasn't already reserved to the states.
The 14th didn't do anything except simply grab onto things like how you get declared a citizen.
Yes.
And the reason that they did that was actually a noble reason, if misguided attempt. And that noble reason was the fact that men of color, black men and black women, were being denied basic constitutional rights because at some point they had not been eligible for citizenship. So they were being denied citizenship on the basis of their race. Well, it's noble that the federal government stepped in. It's a noble thought. However, in practice, it didn't work out very well because the 14th Amendment has been essentially expanded to imply that a lot of the things that used to be reserved to the states by places like the 10th Amendment and Article 1, Section 8 and Article 1, Section 9 have suddenly been taken, made federal. They've been federalized through the 14th Amendment, which, by the way, if you really kind of look into the history of the 14th Amendment, that was never what it was designed to do. So that's my problem with what is being done with the 14th Amendment. But what else is new? People design things to do one thing, and somebody twists them into something else.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, Chuck. I want to kind of jump back a little bit because, again, I want to say that I do understand Dr. Dobson's position on this matter. I do think maybe, though, he may be a bit broad in his approach, you know, because he said, and I quote, "I do not recall a time when the institutions of marriage and the family have faced such peril." Well, Dr. Dobson basically says, and this is in his comments in an article from WorldNet Daily that was published, well, we're taping this today on Monday on the 4th, and this was published yesterday evening, and basically said, "I do not recall a time when the institutions of marriage and the family have faced such peril, or when the forces arrayed against them were more formidable or determined." Now, this is a letter he sent out to his support base. He said, "Barring a miracle, the family that has existed since antiquity will likely crumble, presaging the fall of Western civilization itself." And he calls on for prayer and petitioning of God. Well, I agree with him in that last point that, yes, you should always pray and petition God. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with him that this is the end of Western civilization, or that the family itself will completely crumble. Now, those families who don't have a biblical worldview, those churches which do not preach the whole counsel of God, yes, they will fall. But, Chuck, rightly so.
Yeah, that's usually a move of God when that happens.
Yes, it is.
Crises in civilizations are generally a move of God to really to broom out the bad players. And, like, this is, as my pastor talked about Sunday, I think we sang in a hymn, that is basically to burn off your dross and refine your gold.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that's exactly what God does. He doesn't let the diseased parts. It's like a fruit tree that has a diseased section. Well, very often, if you can cut the diseased section off, you can save the tree, and not only save the tree, but it produces more, better fruit faster than if you let the diseased part of the tree stay there.
Right.
And that's what God does. God prunes his church.
Right. So, again, I mean, in one sense, I understand what Dr. Dobson's doing, because he's trying to wake his own network up to say, you know, there's a lot more at stake here than whether or not two people who have the same body parts should be given a marriage license. Because, honestly, Charles, and we know this, because that's not really what the end game is in this respect. It's definitely an issue. It's going to be an issue. And as a matter of fact, and this is an article you pointed out that we want to go into and talk about a little bit about this issue. The quote, it is going to be an issue, unquote, is the title of the Reverend Albert Moeller's commentary that was put out today that I think was very spot on. Al Mohler is the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary down in Kentucky. Nationally known conservative commentator, has radio program, writes all over the country. And he basically says that, you know, this issue is broader and deeper than just about marriage. And he's backed up by no better source than one of the attorneys who was arguing the case to overturn the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decision in the Obergefell case and force same-sex marriage recognition upon the entire country. The U.S. Solicitor General, who is arguing in favor of the homosexual rights movement.
And what a sad day it is when the existing law, the United States Attorney is supposed to argue in favor of existing law. When you've got a case where the United States Attorney is arguing against existing law, as duly passed by Congress, you have an issue. And you have a major issue between the legislative and the executive branch, because essentially the Solicitor General works for the executive branch, which is really this is one of the places where the Constitution allows a little bit too close a working relationship between the judicial branch and the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
It's through the Justice Department. The separation of powers almost disappear when the Solicitor General is arguing against the United States Congress for the executive branch. There is an issue involved there. One thing I will say about Al Mohler, absolutely drop dead, probably one of the most intelligent men I can think of off the top of my head. Don't always agree with him. However, what I would do if I were you out there in listener land, I would, if you have iTunes, suggest that you subscribe to his daily briefing. The daily briefing is about 20 minutes long or so, and it's Al Mohler commenting on the issues of the day. Absolutely an indispensable resource. If you don't listen to the daily briefing, you're missing out on what the intellect of faith is saying and speaking to issues of government and social policy.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, Dr. Mohler, in his article, talks about this idea that religious liberty is really in the crosshairs,
exactly,
of the same-sex marriage movement. And it comes during the oral arguments over the issue when Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, who works for the Obama administration, was up taking questions from the justices after they had issued a brief in support of overturning the Sixth Circuit's ruling. Now, for those of you who've not listened to our program before, we've talked about this. The Sixth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is based in Cincinnati, ruled finding that the states had reserved the power and the right to determine what a marriage is within their state and determine who they were going to recognize as being married. The decision coming from a majority opinion writer, Justice Jeffrey Sutton, was a classic treatise on federalism, true federalism.
True federalism, which is not the same as modern federalism.
As the modern federalism idea where it's what the federal government doesn't want to do, then the states get to do.
The federal government gets to hand out the powers, right, where in fact it's supposed to be the state government handing out the powers.
It's the other way around. And Justice Sutton recognized that and wrote a stunningly brilliant decision in this Obergefell case. I can't even say the guy's name, but he's the survivor of a male homosexual pairing who sued because he couldn't get survivor benefits from his deceased lover's estate. So that was part of why Obergefell had sued over this. And that was the case. Of course, he sued the Ohio Department of Health because they wouldn't recognize the marriage license, supposedly,
right,
et cetera. Anyhow, so the courts were hearing this, and Solicitor General Donna Verrilli comes up, and he's going back and forth about these issues and about legalization of same-sex marriage, which, honestly, those two phrases in the same sentence is an oxymoron, because
right,
you can't legalize something that God says it cannot be recognize and is an abomination. And again, I'm letting my worldview slip show. And he basically gets down to a bunch of questions that they were asked. And there were different exchanges, you know, obviously some of the ones that we know of, Antonin Scalia, others. But Chief Justice Roberts asked this question of the Solicitor General, and he said, no, wait a minute. He goes, would a religious school that has married housing, i.e. housing for married couples, be required to afford such housing to same-sex couples if they rule that it should be recognized legally across the fruited plain? And the Solicitor General hum-hawed around, and he kind of dodged and dived. He didn't say no, but he tried to kind of end run around because he didn't want to answer it directly. And he's like, well, the federal government doesn't have a law banning discrimination in such matters and blah, blah, blah. And it's going to depend on how the states work out the balance between their civil rights laws. Ah, look, now he's becoming a federalist. It's going to depend on what the states do. Blah, 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 blah. You know, he goes on and on and on and on. And he said, well, different states could strike different balances. And basically, he really had said, and this is what Albert Mohler says. He says, make no mistake. The Solicitor General of the United States just announced that the rights of a religious school to operate on the basis of its own religious faith will survive only as an, quote, accommodation, unquote, on a state-by-state basis, and only until the federal government passes its own legislation with whatever accommodation might be included in that law. Funny, Chuck, we just talked the other day about the RFRA passage in Indiana, which became a Equal Housing and Employment Act for the homosexuals with accommodation for religious groups to be able to continue to do what they're doing. Now, Charles, you understand the United States Constitution. You know Article 6 very well, the Supremacy Clause. Yep. How where on the pecking order does state statutes fall in relation to federal statutes?
Well, they come under them in areas where there is a specific power delegated to the federal government.
Aha! Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate it. See, this is your constitutional moment, ladies and gentlemen. You get one of these every week with when we're live. And that is, again, federal law, but this is what will be used. They'll argue that federal law trumps the state law no matter what, but it only trumps it in areas where the federal government has been given authority under the United States Constitution to make such laws. And Charles, help me a little bit. I know I've read this somewhere before. I don't think it was in the Constitution, though, because I didn't see anywhere in the Constitution where it said that the Congress shall make a law regarding who can marry who.
Yeah, it's nowhere in there. I can assure you that Article 1, Section 8 contains nothing about the federal government shall be empowered to decide what the definition of marriage. There are a whole lot of things that the federal government is not empowered to do that they have usurped the power to do, but that's one of them that
Are you absolutely certain that it isn't hiding in the emanations from the penumbras and the shadows of Mark and Reprisal? Because maybe we missed something on that.
Yes, Letter of Mark and Reprisal. No, I'm afraid it's not in the Letter of Mark and Reprisal.
I didn't think it was either. So what's going to happen is, because we have shoddy constitutional scholarship right now, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about shoddy constitutional scholarship in a minute, we have a situation where even the United States Solicitor General is arguing, well, we'll leave it up to the states to figure out how they accommodate things until the federal government decides to, like, bring the hammer down. Chuck, that's a huge problem. But you know what? This high idea of it is going to be an issue, that isn't what they're talking about directly. I mean, it keeps going on a little
bit. Well, Barry, that's a tacit admission that they have adopted a Gramscian strategy on... And now, people won't know what that means, but yes, they've adopted a Gramscian strategy on this whole question. In other words, it's Lenin called it two steps forward, one step back.
Yes.
Gramsci's thing was the long march through the institutions.
That's right.
Here's where we see it. Basically, what they're saying is, well, we'll give on this piece of this issue for now, mm-hmm, until we think we have our ducks enough in a row that we can grab the power and pass legislation at the federal level to essentially steal the religious liberty of the institutions.
Yes.
In question.
Well, and here's where the rubber met the road on this, because Al Mohler says, you know, the Chief Justice asked the unavoidable question when he specifically asked about campus housing for religious schools. If a school cannot define its housing policies on the basis of its religious beliefs, then it's denied the ability to operate on the basis of those beliefs. And he said that, they, you know, that's one of the big three issues, maintaining admission, hiring, and student services on the basis of your belief. That's what distinctive creates the distinctive for a Christian or religious school. You know, that we have a policy called a statement of faith and a statement of conduct that has to go to those who want to seek admission as a student, those who want to seek admission as faculty, and those who want to get services from the school when you're in here. Mohler goes down and says, you know what? All three of these are now directly threatened. The Solicitor General admitted that these liberties will be accommodated or not, depending on how states define their laws. And the laws of the states would lose relevance the moment the federal government adopts its own law. Now, you know, I got to chide Al Mohler a little bit. He's even fallen somewhat in the coma of the seduction of, if the federal government passes it, then it's the law of the land.
And that's when I said earlier that I sometimes don't agree with him. He's a little too conciliatory to the idea that the Supremacy Clause says that, well, if the feds say so, then that's the fact. Right. That's not the fact.
And they brought up another piece, and this is where Sam Alito, Justice Samuel Alito, came in with a question that got to force the Solicitor General to basically do a mea culpa. And Alito said, you know, wait a minute, what about the right of religious institutions to maintain their tax-exempt status? And he cited a previous Supreme Court decision to allow the IRS to strip Bob Jones of its tax status because of their policy against interracial dating and interracial marriage, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Horrible policy.
It's a stupid policy.
Yeah. Crazy policy. They rescinded it, but the point is that the court's decision in that case set the stage for Alito's next question to the Solicitor General. He said, would the same apply to a university or college if it opposed same-sex marriage? I.e., if they opposed interracial marriage, are we now putting that on an equivalent footing? And Varelli said, quote, you know, I don't think I can answer that question without knowing more specifics, but it's certainly going to be an issue. I don't deny that. I don't deny that, Justice Alito. It is going to be an issue. Oh, boy, is it ever going to be an issue,
you
Charles.
Bet. You bet.
And that is the whole point, is that really, he got flushed out.
Yeah, exactly.
This is part of in-game strategy, and it's now getting laid out as a question in front of the court. Big problem for the United States Solicitor General, who's operating under the auspices of the United States Department of Justice, who operates under the auspices of
the executive branch
of government, which is run by
Barack Obama.
Who has already come out and said that Christian schools are going to be treated a little bit differently post Supreme Court. You know, this is interesting, folks, that we see the battle lines forming. But the problem is these battle lines have been forming for an awfully long time. As a matter of fact, some of the cases that started us down this road didn't start in 2013.
No.
You know, everybody points to the Windsor case about overturning the federal DOMA. Well, that was kind of tipping point toward endgame. Where this really began was in the 60s, Chuck, with the fact that we were going to push religious belief and religious expression out of the public square in the public schools, that we were going to capitulate and say that there are certain rights that really are, as I made that quote earlier from Stuart, the penumbras, the emanation from the penumbras of the Constitution, because that was language that was found in Roe v. Wade. These are the types of things, this is the type of movement that we're seeing coming. And Chuck, you know, you and I both have been observers of this cultural trend now for a long time.
I'm going to say that it goes back further than the 1960s.
Oh, I'm sure that it does.
It goes back to the 1940s.
Okay, I'll give you that.
1947, Everson versus Board of Education.
Sure.
Because what came out of that case? They dusted off an old letter written by
Thomas Jefferson
to the Danbury Baptist Association, completely cut the answer that he wrote to them out of its context and suddenly applied it to federal law. And what was that about? That was about the quote-unquote separation of church and state. That is one of the major seeds that's growing up into this. Now what's happening is we've perverted the idea that of the separation of church and state, which was the idea that the church could not be under assault by the state, to the idea that the church can have no say whatsoever in anything that goes on in the state. Basically, they took the First Amendment, which basically says Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of a national religion nor interfering with the free exercise thereof, and turned it on its head and turned that into separation of church and state.
Uh-huh, that's true.
And once you do that, once you get that confusion going in people's heads, the idea that, well, you know, the church is completely under the thumb of the state, which is what that statement really says, that idea that separation of church and state, the way it's put after Everson, is the idea that the church is under the thumb of the state. No, the church is a separate institution. It has separate loyalties. Yes. Does it exist inside the state? Yes. Is the church really, quote-unquote, you know, part of the case? Will the church feel tax-exempt status issues from this? And basically the Solicitor General was basically saying, I don't want to talk about that. The answer is, yeah, it will be. But the fact is that the church is not tax exempt. The church is tax immune.
Yes, it is.
And by that I mean, whether the state grants it or not, the church is supposed to be immune from taxes from the state because it's an entirely different form of governmental institution. It is a church government institution. It's not, I mean, basically, yes, does the church outlaw certain kinds of worship?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, you're not allowed to do infant sacrifice. You're not allowed to cut the living hearts out of virgins. Yeah, you're not allowed to do animal sacrifices and those kinds of things. Yes, are those forbidden? Yes, why? Well, bottom line, why? Is because it flies in the face of Christian theology.
Yes, it does.
If you get right down to the bottom line, does that mean that the church has interfered with the practice thereof? Well, within certain bounds, yes, because that's not an absolute thing. Again, virgin sacrifice, any number of things you can imagine that could be done that would be horrible things. Yes, they're forbidden because they fly in the face of the institution of the Christian religion, which was the supporting foundation of the foundation of the United States.
You're right. You're right. But you know what? I'm going to go back even further because proponents broadening the definition of marriage to include homosexual, same-sex couples would go all the way back to the 1860s, Charles.
Okay.
They would say that in 1865, I think it was 1866, no, it was 67, excuse me, when the 14th Amendment was adopted, that was the beginning of setting the wheels in motion for, quote-unquote, equality today. As a matter of fact, some of these scholars argue, that it's a misunderstanding of the 14th Amendment to say that it was written to just protect racial minorities, which, if you've read the history of the development of the 14th Amendment, I know you have. That's exactly what it was intended for.
That was exactly what it was for.
But here is Judith Schaefer, who's the vice president of the Constitutional Accountability Center.
Oh, please.
Boy, I love that name. Maybe we should come up with a big name like that.
We do. Institute for Principled Policy.
Yeah, we do have that. But here she says, she goes, the 14th Amendment, quote, was designed to, really, and you know when they throw a really in there, they're trying to sell you on something.
Right.
We're designed to really perfect the promise of the Declaration of Independence. And she says, quote, "The purpose and the meaning of the 14th Amendment is to make clear that no state can take no group of citizens and make them second class," unquote. Charles, you know what? This is wonderful historical revisionism on display here. Judith Schaefer has basically now said, according to her, and since she's an expert, it can't be argued or denied,
quote unquote,
that the only reason that the 14th Amendment was passed was to make clear that no state can take no groups of citizens and make them second class. And that perfects the promise of the Declaration of Independence. That's funny because if I remember from the Declaration of Independence and from constitutional history, most of the provisions were keyed to giving rights to vote, rights to the franchise, to those who held property.
Oh, that's correct.
Because they had a bigger stake involved in it. And also, yes, we understand from the Reconstruction amendments, the Reconstruction era amendments, that the 14th Amendment was passed specifically to protect ex-slaves and blacks who were had been and were being emancipated at that time. But it's interesting the argument that Schaefer uses, because really on its core, this argument is one that in 2015 harkens back to a decision that was also issued in the 19-teens by another Supreme Court justice by the name of Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. We talk about it in our Institute on the Constitution class.
I think I know where you're going.
You talk about the Holland versus Missouri case where Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was an associate justice who wrote the decision in the case, basically said that the Constitution is a living, breathing organism. And that, quote, even those who beget it couldn't really have envisioned what it could be used for. And it's funny because in this, part of this article is off of Vox.com. I don't suggest you go there. It's a liberal site.
Ultra liberal
site, but we want to look at both sides of this issue. And they're arguing, and they have the quote from Judith Schaefer in here, and it says that basically constitutional scholars argue that the amendment was purposely broad to protect anyone from discrimination, even groups of people that the amendment's authors couldn't possibly predict would face discrimination or one day be accepted by society. Chuck, that's the living document theory of the Constitution.
It's writ large.
And that's what they're basically saying is we have to adopt Oliver Wendell Holmes' evolutionary view of the Constitution to say, well, the founders didn't mean what they said because they couldn't have possibly understood what we're doing today. And in order to justify what we're doing today, we're going to have to lean back on and say that this is what they really meant.
What she's saying is that they were such geniuses they didn't know what they were saying.
Exactly. So basically, when the 14th Amendment was written, even in that lovely period in the late 1860s, they all really were basically saying that two men should be able to have sexual intercourse and call it a marriage.
Okay, Barry, there is a major category error here.
Oh, well, yes. Not for me, though.
No. I'm not. A category error in the world of logical fallacy is something that's so completely beyond, you're comparing apples and oranges. If you know the phraseology, you're saying, well, wow, those orange apples are terrible. They're kind of sour and they've got a funky rind. You can't eat it. It's all bitter. It's the worst apple I've ever seen.
Yeah. I've had some of those apples.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's because you've made a category error. An orange is not an apple.
That's right.
It's an orange, and yeah, it has a not a very tasty rind, and it's orange in color, and blah blah blah. That's a category error. So what's the category error? The category error is the idea that somehow skin color and racial makeup, which are really artificial concepts from a Christian perspective, they're simply an accident of where you're born in the world.
Yes.
For the most part, or where your ancestors were born in the world. And sexual behavior, your strong sexual desire, are somehow the same. The argument being that, quote unquote, you're born the way you are, which opens up a can of worms that basically nobody's willing to talk about. And that can of worms is that you open up the idea that all kinds of sexual activity that is considered abnormal, that are considered, as you started at the beginning of the mm-hmm. of the show, you called it the same-sex aberration, I think.
Yes.
If you will, there's a whole list. I won't name them here. You can guess what they are.
Oh, of sexual orientation?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, as far as I know, there are over 500 different orientations that are recognized in medical literature. And folks, this runs the gamut, and you don't even have to go there. But if you can orient yourself sexually to it, there's a philia or some kind of medical term for it.
A fetish or whatever.
Whatever.
That being said, some people are saying, well, since the assumption is that you feel that from birth, and that homosexuality, since that's what we're talking about right now, is something that you have, that you're born with it. And you'll even hear some people who call themselves quote-unquote conservative Christians saying, well, people are born that way. Well, look, we're all born sinners. And is homosexuality a sin? The answer is absolutely yes. The practice of homosexuality, the desire for homosexuality. But guess what? All kinds of people have all kinds of different desires that they don't act on. Is it sinful? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. But the fact is that a lot of people don't practice on those sins because they know they're sins, so they avoid them. They do things to get away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Homosexuality has been given a special status. So if you want to talk about special statuses, it's this basically perverse desire that has been elevated even above normal sexual desire
mm-hmm.
between peoples of opposite sexes. And you put it in the same category as people of opposite sexes with different skin colors who are attracted to one another.
Mm-hmm.
That's an absurdity.
Yes. Well, it is. But, you know, Chuck, as I sit there and I dwell on this, and I dwell on the commentary from the supposed constitutional expert at the I forgot what beautiful name they use for that. The Constitutional Accountability Center, Gina
right,
Schaefer.
Right.
I got to thinking about this, and it's like, okay, well, wait a minute. If the purpose and meaning of the 14th Amendment that says no state can take no group of citizens and make them second class, what about Christians? Folks, it's an either-or proposition. You can't have both. Christ has said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And you know, contrary to some of the popular in the liberal circles mentality, well, Jesus never said anything negative about homosexuality. Jesus is part of the Trinity. If you're Trinitarian, he's part of the Godhead. He's one of the three in one, and that means that he is God the Father and God the Son and God the Holy Spirit, which means that from before the foundation of the world, or in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God.
Yes.
Means in the beginning, God, Jesus, and the Spirit, because we're Trinitarian in our belief structure.
And that's part of the problem, Barry, is so many people have adopted a Unitarian view of the faith.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that includes evangelicals and not everybody, but there are a lot of churches out there, especially liberal churches, who have adopted a Unitarian view. And in fact, are functionally Unitarian, although they claim still to be Trinitarian. They're not. Jesus and God and the Holy Spirit are separate things. All you have to do is, well, the Father's the God of the Old Testament and Jesus is the God of the New Testament. No, they're all three the God of both Testaments.
Right. And for all of those who say that we're intolerant, the question is, you know, even if you use this argument on the 14th Amendment, then the argument stands that then you must protect my ability to hold my particular viewpoint and my belief system, and therefore I can't be forced to participate in somebody's homosexual pairing, whether I'm a pastor, a baker, a photographer, a florist, or if I have a, you know, a limousine rental company and I decide I don't want to have two guys in the back seat after their quote-unquote nuptials getting frisky with each other. I really don't want to see that or be right. part of that, you know. But that's the problem, Chuck, for the tolerance crowd. You know, and the reason why these questions at the United States Supreme Court are so vitally important, because as Al Mohler says here, that he quotes another constitutional scholar and observer by the name of Mark Stern, and he says that he's right that the victory of same-sex marriage means the victory of an, quote, egalitarian-based ethic over a faith-based one, unquote. And the remaining question, he said then, Al Mohler says, is, quote, whether champions of tolerance are prepared to tolerate proponents of a different ethical vision, unquote. Even then, he warned, quote, I think the answer will be no, unquote. I really think that he's just dead on to this, and the fact that this situation here is, this is what's before the justices of the United States Supreme Court, is first and foremost, are they going to impose by fiat a new ethical standard upon the entire culture, even against states? And they're already starting to do so by not hearing. When all these cases started coming up out of other circuits, they were all in favor of overturning state amendments and forcing, quote-unquote, marriage equality, as they call it, upon other states, like West Virginia.
Another category error,
another by the way. You're right, but the point is that not only do they have to do that, they have to understand that it really, in one great sense, is a zero-sum game. You can't have multiple ethical frameworks and still call yourself a society. It doesn't work. I can't say I am in favor of murder and I'm not in favor of murder. Or I can redefine what murder is and call it choice and still say that I am morally upright and I can sustain a culture.
You just brought up a point that I'm going to say, I'm going to give kudos to the genius of the framers. And you and I have just had a discussion,
yes,
a long discussion about the, in fact, I just wrote an article, ladies and gentlemen, I would invite you to go out to an article that I've written. It's not on this subject. It's on the subject of a new constitutional convention, but it addresses this question on the framers. It's called Paved with Good Intentions. It's on the front page right now. And it talks about the fact that the framers, we're not a monolithic body. We're not designing something. They weren't all of one mind on what they were building. And when they were done, they weren't all of one mind on what they had built. So that being said, the genius of the framers was in basically places like the Article 4 of the Constitution, where they gave leeway to the states to recognize the fact that not everybody in the union had the same cultures. And that was the full faith and credit clause.
Yes.
Had all the same cultures as, and because culture is, where does it show itself in government? Through law.
Through law. But remember, culture is your religion externalized. And so if it shows itself through law, then your law has to be based in your ethical or religious foundation.
Exactly. So basically, what they did was they designed a mechanism where the states, in places where the federal government did not speak, if a state had a strong public policy against a certain thing that another state allowed, then the states didn't have to recognize that law.
Right.
And that's what DOMA was. DOMA was an Article 4 law. That basically,
yes,
Congress has the right to set the effects of the laws of one state on another. And in order to protect them, the states that didn't want to have homosexual marriage in their states, what they did was they passed the DOMA, and it basically said, okay, the effect of homosexual marriage in states that already have a strong public policy against it or are going to make a strong public policy against it is zero. In other words, they don't have to recognize it, because people don't remember the first state to come out with homosexual marriage. There was an article that we were reading today that basically talked about, and it's incorrect. One of the things articles we looked at for today, mm-hmm. Basically said it was Massachusetts in 2003. Wrong-o.
It was Hawaii.
It was Hawaii in 1993 or 4.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so what states did was immediately, A, petition for DOMA, and B, pass strong laws against such a thing. Now, basically, what did the Supreme Court do when, what was it, 2 years ago?
Well, 2013 was when the federal DOMA was overturned in the United States versus Windsor right. case. But you have to think about this, though, Chuck. Even if you count Hawaii in, that means that up until 2014, there were only 8 states right. in total who had, in one way or the other, and the vast majority of them were not by popular vote, they were by court rulings, had forced homosexual pairing
in every
approval.
Case.
Yes. You had Hawaii, Massachusetts, California, but then in 2 weeks, they collected over 1 million signatures and overturned it, put it on the ballot as Proposition 8, and 52% of the California electorate said, no, we don't want this, overturned it. But we can't have the will of the voters, so the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Prop 8.
Yeah. By the way, I saw that 52% number. I think that stat is wrong.
Actually, it may be a little bit stiffer than that.
I think it was 58.
I think it was closer to 58. Yeah, that's
we can check that out, it doesn't matter.
You're right. And you go at Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, Maryland, and Washington State. And then after all that, that's when Windsor came out. But then what we had were all of these people who were running to these states to get these quote-unquote marriage licenses were coming back to their home states, Ohio, Tennessee, Michigan, Kentucky, et cetera.
And demanding benefits.
And demanding recognition and benefits because of this supposed issue. Now, there still is the full faith and credit that it's up to the state to determine to what extent they're going to recognize
right.
For that as well. And really what we got down to, Chuck, was that of the 35 or 36 states right now, supposedly, that where same-sex marriage is legal, only 8 actually, by one means or the other, passed it. The other 27 states, it was forced upon them by a federal circuit court judge.
That's it.
Who, because they happen to be in the same circuit as a case coming through from another state, when the federal circuit said, well, the people cannot stop gay marriage, they were forced to recognize. Now, the point is, they were forced because they didn't have the will to say, oh, really? You made the rule? Well, okay, you enforce it.
Well, if you think about it, that's the most absurd set of rules, that it only works in the circuit where you are. If this is a federal ruling, then why isn't it federal wide? And the answer is because they've got a goofy set of rules. Even they understand that there is some federalism involved. It's a halfway federal covenant is basically what that goes down to. Now, my point was that this whole idea that the genius of the founders was, they created this system where you didn't have to accept it. Now, what do liberals say? You have to do it our way. We don't care if you're in the minority. And the fact is, in those states, they were in the minority. This is why liberals really hate things broken down by states. Because though there are majorities in a number of states that disagree with them. If you look at the overall numbers, there may be a large number of people in California, a large number of people in New York, a large number of people in Illinois. The more popular states may overwhelm the majorities of the smaller states.
Mm-hmm.
Barry, this is why we choose a president the way we do through the Electoral College. This is why we don't
have... That's the reason why we have to get rid of the Electoral College.
Yes.
So that those wiser heads in the more populous areas can prevail, right?
This is exactly why we have by state and by district representation in Congress, and not everybody is an at-large. Because if everybody was an at-large in Congress, all the congressmen would be from California, New York, Illinois, Florida, Texas.
Right, exactly. Exactly. That's what you would end up having, because that's where the main population centers are.
Yep. And nobody would be there from Delaware, from Wyoming,
Vermont.
From Montana, Vermont.
Yeah. Idaho.
Yeah.
We could go on and on.
Name a western state. Yeah. Well, except for on the directly on the coast.
Right.
And even Oregon wouldn't have very many.
No. Not at all.
So this is, we have to stop our thinking from the idea of thinking about the people overall and thinking about districts. Does a given district want this? Does a given state want it? And the answer is no. Ohio proved that. What was our marriage? 63%. Now, would that number hold today? Probably not, but I'm betting it would be over 55 still.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and the reason that I say this, you take a poll and you ask somebody, the guy doesn't want to be embarrassed by the poll taker.
That's right.
So he says what will keep the poll taker happy. Now, I'm not just quoting this off the top of my head. There was a book called The Day America Told the Truth. And basically, this is exactly what they said. People will tell poll takers what they think they want to hear. But in fact, when they vote very differently than what they've told the poll takers that they're going to do. This is the problem with polls, especially on hot-button issues. On this Vox article, they've got this big thing about there's 220 million people who see it our way.
Well, that's begging the question,
exactly,
though, isn't it?
Exactly. I don't think the numbers are anywhere near that high.
They're not, because what they're doing is they're calculating in the populations of all the states that have had it forced upon them,
right,
by these federal circuit court rulings.
It's an assumption.
Yeah, it's an assumption.
It's an assumption that, it's forced on us, and therefore that's the way we are.
Well,
we have to be very careful thinking in these terms.
Well, let me give you the idea of a thought of one of the justices who, during the oral arguments, said this. This is Justice Stephen Breyer. And his thought, his musing on this issue as the oral arguments were going on were this. You know, he says in that quote, "The opposite view, that is, traditional marriage, has been the law everywhere for thousands of years among people who are not discriminating even against gay people. And suddenly you want 9 people outside the ballot box to require states that don't want to do it, to change what marriage is, and to include gay people. Why cannot those states at least wait and see whether, in fact, doing so in the other states is or is not harmful to marriage?" Breyer's showing incredible restraint. He's like, wait a minute. So you're wanting us to force it on everybody. What happened to the idea of these states who say they really just don't want to do it? Let's step back, and the ones who do want to do it, let them do it. And the ones who don't want to do it, they don't have to. And then if we get down the road and decide, oh, all of a sudden, hey, you know what? It was great for everybody in, you know, economic development, blah, 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 creative class, all that garbage that's been pumped out. That's all wonderful. It works. And so other states are like, ooh, that worked. Oh, let's go try it. No, what they want is we want 5 people outside the ballot box. He said 9 people. We only need 5.
5,
Justice,
yeah,
Breyer. To basically force, with the threat of the government action behind it, to basically accede to the new ethic. Chuck, that's the definition of dictatorship.
Exactly. It's essentially oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
It's an oligarchy. I want to know, for instance, why justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg wasn't required to recuse herself, because if I'm not mistaken, she's already performed a marriage ceremony.
She has, and that question came up, but obviously the wagons got drawn in together in a circle around her.
And that's unfortunately one of the problems that you have when you have a Supreme Court that practices a power it was never given in the Constitution. And that's correct. Is judicial review of the law. That is not part of their constitutional duties. Yes, folks, I know I'm going against the common wisdom grain. And frankly, I can prove that. We don't have enough time left today for me to prove that to you, but I can prove it, and I have proved it in our Constitution class. Because I've been asked that question, and it's in Article 3, and it's basically the section that says that all questions of law and equity come before this court. And everybody says, see, it says that. No. The word equity is a word that basically means the just application of a law on a case-by-case basis. In other words, case law applies to the litigants, not to the Constitution in its entirety. That was a minor proof. If you want to go deeper into that, basically you have to see where John Marshall seized the power to do judicial review. So that being the case, you know, I think did you read that thing out of the Vox article? We're going to attach links to all these articles so you can go out and read for yourself. Now, one thing I discovered, as I discover in all these things when I read them, immediately the Vox article does what I expected it to do. It makes another one of these category errors. Because in there's a picture of Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the 60s. And it says, a quote, Chief Justice Earl Warren, Supreme Court struck down states' interracial marriage bans. Well, indeed, they did do that. And they should have done that if they had the power of judicial review, which they don't. But what the states' interracial marriage bans were wrong, but they should have been struck down by the states. But that being said, again, it's the argument that somehow sexual preference is the same as racial identity. It's not. It's nothing like racial identity.
Mm-hmm.
Again, racial identity is an accident of birth. Sexual preference is not. And where do we, you know, how can you make people, especially the church, see that, Barry? We have a lot of people in the church who are falling for the arguments because they're not really well-versed in critical thinking.
That is true, Charles. We're going to have a big problem. Now, the problem is twofold. And I think Dr. Dobson, who we talked about at the beginning, is part of the issue where they've put too much weight on the temporal versus the spiritual. Yes, are the liberals pushing hard and are we in peril and they're aligned against us? Of course. But then, to use the old Chesty Puller, we've got the enemy to the right, to the left, to the front, and to the rear. We have them right where we want them. We can't miss.
That's it. And Chinese to the north, Chinese to the south, Chinese to the east, Chinese to the west. We can shoot in any direction. Yeah.
That's right. And so, you know, you have to look at it in that sense, but you also have to look at it in the sense that, Chuck, I'm hoping that this will wake up the church to abandon this pluralistic, radical two kingdoms, separation of church and state mantra. We can't talk about politics in the church or any divisive issues because it may offend somebody. Folks, the gospel is divisive. It's offensive because it's truth.
Right.
And truth divides between bone and marrow like a two-edged sword.
Okay, if you want some training in critical thinking, some logical fallacy detection, guess what? I'm teaching at Camp American this year. It's the first time I've taught it in about 4 years or maybe more. It's time for you to sign up. If you're 12 and above, and that goes through adulthood, 12 and above, please sign up for Camp American, www.campamerican.com. Come on out. If you volunteer, you get to come for free. If you have children, you get you bring your children when you volunteer, or a cousin or a nephew or a grandchild or whatever. Guess what? You get a discount. So again, www.campamerican.com. Barry's going to teach. I'm going to teach. Michael Kaufman, Joel McDermott's going to be talking about his book, God versus Socialism. Dr. Kaufman, God, Government, and Global Governance. David Whitney's going to be talking about lessons from Ahab on property ownership. Ahab from the Bible, not Captain Ahab from Moby Dick. Not the same thing.
Yeah, we don't want to go there.
So again, www.campamerican.com. And we're out of time for this week, so join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.